all the musicians that I know and those that I've worked with over the years, one stands out as an artist who embodies what it means to create and believe in pure music, who harnesses its power for good in this world. From an angry young guitar slinger with a barbed wire view of injustice to shamanic visionary, Robbie Robb has eschewed commercial success to blaze his own trail and tell his own truth, all couched inside some of the most inspiring and challenging music on the planet. So I'm so proud and honored to be hosting Robbie Robb. How are you, man?
Hey, man.
Been a long time.
Introduction. You made me cry, man.
Oh, well, that's cool, Rob.
Man, you touched me now.
When did music take over your life? At what point did you go, I want to play. That's all I want to do.
Well, you know, I started smoking dacha pretty young age. And because my mom had a, you know, she started developing Buddhism, bringing Buddhism to to South Africa. And she had the center, Buddhist meditation center. And so she had all these hippies would come there. And these hippies had, you know, they bring their records, vinyls, and I'd hear this strange music and this, you know, and at the same time, you know, I'm listening to Creedence and Sugar, and all those things. Archies, I love the Archies, you know. And of course, I fell in love with the song Lola, which changed me quite intensely. I was like, I know what I want to do when I heard that song, you know. And the other song was, hey, wow, 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 wow.
Ah, Crimson and Clover.
When she come walking, no. Yeah, well, that when he says, when she come walking, that, hey. I understood that sound. Inside that sound is a sound of soul, of all kinds of things, you know. It's not a rejoiceful. They said that John Lennon did that first, sing a sad song, sing a love song in a sad voice. Mm. I'm not sure about that, but I heard it in that thing, you know, that, hey. And I knew what I wanted to do then, but I couldn't quite put it in words. Now I see all these hippies are bringing these beautiful records and strange records. Aphrodite's Child, 666. Mm. I used to stare at that cover, that car crash in the middle. I used to get so spooked out. And when the lamb opened the seventh seal, and I was a freak out. I was just stare at that album, stare. Read the liner notes again and again, play it again, read the liner notes, freaking out. And then they took me to the farm where they had, you know, community of these hippies. There was a band there called Snow. And I'm not 100% sure if they are some of the members of Suck or something like that, but they look like the same band, you know. Mm. And so I became friends with Snow. And then walking home from school, I lived in Parkhurst at the time. I walk past his house on the corner and I hear the thumping, boom, boom, boom. And what's that? I go and I sneak up to the garage door and I hear this music coming. So I sit for a while. Then I sneak, the next time I go, I sneak a little closer to the door. A little closer to the other door, and eventually this guy busts me, and I'm like, ah, sorry, man. He's like, no, what do you want? Come inside. And it's Otis Waygood Blues Band. And so they take me inside. They immediately give me an album, a cover. I mean, what do you call it? An album cover. And they put the dacha there, and they tell me, hey, clean the pips out. I don't know what they're even talking about, right? So they showed me how to clean out the pips. So I clean out the pips. And I listened to them rehearse. Then they took me to a concert. And you see me sitting at the concert. I'm actually on the record cover. Otis Waygood Blues Band, What 10 Light Claps and a Scream.
Oh, you look on the back, yeah? Is that you?
I'm the one who's sitting with his fingers in the ears on the speaker.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
I'm sitting
amazing.
Right on the speaker. Yeah, I'm sitting right on the speaker. And what I'm doing is I'm putting my fingers in and out my ears like a chop, 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 chop. I'm creating like a tremolo effect. Tripping out of my brain, you know, not tripping because I was too young to take acid, but I was already getting like, you know, they say some kids spin around when they're kids, and those kids are probably going to become drug addicts because they dig the high. But I was, you know, so I was doing that. So then it just grew in me. I kind of knew. And then, of course, I think David Marks was, you know, he's playing the flute there, you know. Through them, then I met Mike Dickman. Do you remember him?
No, the folk player.
Beautiful, beautiful songwriter. Never heard songs like that since, you know. He was kind of like a little bit of a Garcia mixed with John Martin and all this stuff, but his strange lyrics, you know. Seven breezes blowing, that kind of feeling to his lyrics. I knew. I wanted to play like that, you know. And then, of course, he would sit there Instead of giving me guitar lessons, they give me tarot lessons. And scare the shit out of me because, you know, there's the devil card and then there's the death card. And I was like, And he was also rebelling against my mother, which was good for me because I was rebelling against her too. Because I didn't want a guru. I wanted a mother. She had put me in and out of orphanages all my early, you know, years, in and out of orphanages. So I just wanted a mother. I didn't want a guru. And he was rebelling against her. And so I joined the revolution.
Who were your early influences as a musician, particularly as a guitar player? Who influenced you to pick up that guitar and that you, the first things that you were listening to?
I think it was the more of the song business that got me in the early days. You know, of course, Donovan was very deep. Mm. That Guinevere, I loved that whole concept of that Guinevere. Hurdy-gurdy man killed me, you know.
Mm.
Then there was Free. Oh, I loved Free. And then the main cat was Johnny Winter. The second Winter album, you know, with that head of his like spinning on both sides.
Only had three sides, remember?
That's right. Another oddity, which yeah. I loved, you know. But there was the one song on there, Fast Life Rider.
Mm.
And they had the tribal drums. And he's just peeling out. In fact, if you listen to, I think it's the last song on my album, 30-Year Experience, was Dr. Space. That album, the last song is called Over the Wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it's talking about that apartheid business. And it's got the almost the similar drums. And I'm doing the Johnny Winter there.
Mm.
Came back. But the thing is, Johnny Winter blew me away. And then everybody was into Hendrix at the time. And I was like, fuck Hendrix. This is the guy, you know. And then, of course, I was still too young to go to the movies. So I stood when Hendrix movie came. And I stood there outside with a pipe trying to make myself look like older so I could sneak into that movie. I got into that movie and I was sitting there and Hendrix comes on, you know, Clapton talks about him a little bit and then Hendrix comes on and he's like low to the ground and he's fucking whoa, 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 doing that thing, wild thing. And I'm like, oh, fuck, I couldn't even look. I had to put my head down like I said, no, I cannot believe what I'm seeing. This is out of control. That was it. And I was like, oh, no, okay. Now what? I learned to sing all the solos on the Band of Gypsies.
Right.
Yeah. So then I got into him, you know.
That was rooted in the blues. But your stepbrother's a gifted blues rock guitarist, Larry Amos.
Yeah, you see, I never knew him. Right. I never knew Larry.
Okay.
He was separated from his mom at a very young age. And we had, it's a very fantastic story. We always had this thing, and I tell people, oh, I've got two brothers somewhere. And I didn't know who they were, where they were. Nobody knew. And then one day, I went on a walkabout. I was about to go to, let's put it this way, I caused a lot of cuck, and they were sending me to Boys Town, actually a division of Boys Town, up in Schoemansdal in New Trichard. So I was, that was my last trip. I was going to this prison, so to speak. And I was hitchhiking all over the country. And I coming home. I get home, my mom says, we found your brother. Now, how that happened is he also would tell people, I've got a brother somewhere, you know?
Mm.
And I would tell people, I got a brother somewhere. And I told this one girlfriend, Tessa Schultz, I said, I got a brother somewhere. And she must have told her mom. And one day, Larry's girlfriend said to him, well, why don't you go on the radio and say, I'm looking for my mom? And he's like, nah, it won't work. And so she cons him into that. He does it, tells the story on the radio, looking for my mom. And the next thing, Tessa Schultz's mother goes upstairs to turn the radio off in Tessa's room. And as she walks in to turn the radio off, she hears this thing, this boy looking for his mother. She remembers the story from Tessa. She calls my mom. She says, I don't know if this is important, but... there's a guy on the radio looking for his mom. My mom, boom, boom, contact.
And that's how you met him?
It was Larry. Yeah, so then she told me, yeah, there's this guy, Larry. And he's coming that same night. I just basically just arrived home. He's coming and he plays guitar and I must please help him, you know, to learn, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah, sure, I'll help him. So we meet on the sand road. He said, hey, my brother. Look, fuck, look at this guy, Larry. I thought, my brother. We go back. I stayed in the little kaya on the farm. It was a kind of a monastery going on there. And Larry, and we pick up the guitar and Larry starts playing. Mm-hmm. And I was fucking gobsmacked. I was, what the fuck is this? Mitichu. That's ridiculous.
Because he's an amazing player.
No. That cat is something else. He's something completely else. You see, even at that time when I met him, I was learning scales and stuff like that in a rush to get good. I had that little thing in me. I wanted to be the fastest guitarist on earth because I saw Alvin Lee, you know? I'm like, fuck it. I'm going to get fast. I'm going to be faster than that shit. And I'm learning my scales and I'm fucking... And here comes Larry and he's like playing three notes here, four notes there. And I'm like, that's what the fuck is that? He can't play, but he can... But what is that? He doesn't know what A minor is. I was thinking, play A minor. He's like fooling me, trying to fool me, like... So I played the chord and he gets it.
Right.
I'm like, he doesn't actually know what I'm talking about. But as soon as I play it, he's got it, you know, phenomenal. And then I would see how he practices. Larry sit there for hours, playing one riff. And you try and talk to him, he look at you, and he's like looking at you, but you're not fucking listening. Very annoying. Just playing the guitar damn all the time, all the time. Unbelievable. And I saw that, and immediately I was like, okay, I got to unlearn all my shit that I've learned. You know, some of my friends were calling me Al the Milkshake, you know, because I was going for the feed. So that was a hell of a thing, you know. Larry was one of my greatest teachers in that way.
He was a blues rock player, but you seemed to shy away from that genre pretty early when you formed Shag, because I saw Shag at the Chelsea Hotel.
Yeah.
Who else was in Shag with you? Robbie Whitelaw was in?
Cliffy Alien.
Oh, the other guitar player.
Cliffy Alien, they used to call us Double Trouble. Cliffy Alien and Dino was in vocals. And, I'm so sorry, I forget the drummer's name. Oh, man. He was a great, very good jazz kind of a drummer. I'm so sorry, I forgot your name, brother. He taught us a lot. Shag, I don't know what was going on with Shag. But I think it was a confusing time. Because Robbie Whitelaw and I were very into funk at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember now. You see, the thing is, I had was taking lessons with Alan Queller,
jazz guitar.
And actually, just prior to that, I had another very, very powerful experience. I walked into the Wits University Hall, and the whole audience was standing up and clapping, and there was this energy going, kah, kah, kah. And I'm like, what's going on? And I look, and I see no music, nothing. And I look at the stage, and there's this black cat. He's just walking that stage, and he's smiling, looking at the audience, big white smile. And the drummer is standing behind the drums, and he's not even doing anything. And then all of a sudden, a couple of licks, and they go, and the whole audience erupts, and then they stop, and the audience is just chuffed. And I'm like, what thing on earth is this? And I go right up to the front of the stage and I'm just staring for Philip Tabani.
Yeah, Malomba.
And that Malomba Jazzman business. Malomba. And I'm like, what on earth is this? They've had more music coming from the silence than they had from the... Those little moments of playing was just like the wheel of silence. They were just tapping this wheel of silence. And the audience was just there. And I was like, okay, I know. And of course, then that was the Van Halen record. And then, of course, we were taking LSD out in the mountains, and in the evenings we'd hear the Africans, and we'd go down there and find them, and they'd be playing the drums, and we'd be tripping out listening to them, and Van Halen on the way there, Led Zeppelin on the way there, and like, I know what to do.
Well, I had the same experience when I saw Malomba the first time, because when I joined Weir Records in 76, my first day at the Weir house, Philip and Gabriel played in the lounge, and I had never seen anything like this in my life. It was like Sun Ra meets Jimi Hendrix meets Berry meets everything. I'd never seen anything. I've always said that it was one of the most amazing experiences.
So then Shag, like I say, we were funky. I was into the funk. I was into the African acid. I'd really coined that term, African acid rock,
Right.
There's got to be a way to make this African. How do I combine Van Halen and Malomba Jazzman drummer? How do I do that? So then we were in Shag, and then we were going this, I would reckon we were at the tail end of, the world was at the tail end of Trapeze and bands like that, Nazareth, and those kind of riff, not quite heavy metal, but you know, riff rock. I don't know really what to call it. And so we were kind of, we didn't have an identity yet. And of course, Dino was standing in front singing, like, I mean, he's like, a, you know, what's that guy from The Who, you know? He's got a hell of a pipes.
Yeah, Daltrey,
but,
yeah.
But also what had happened to me then is prior to that, like I said, I had the lessons with Alan Queller. And Queller said to me, Robbie, there's a band playing. And so now I'm taking a lesson with Alan Queller. I'm like, well. And he says to me, hey, this band, 8-piece jazz band. And I'm like, okay, I'll go there. They accept me into it. Everybody's baffled. I'm baffled. They baffled. We get our first gig, Botswana. I'm the only white guy around for miles. And it's a Christmas and New Year's. And I'm like staying in the little hut. And every morning the drummer gets up, makes a fire, puts the iron on the fire, ironing his clothes, picking his clothes, cleaning himself. All day. His name was Salt. I said to him, Salt, what are you doing, man? I was like, wait a minute, man. The generosity of these black folk, the food, that, you know, you go to their house, there's nothing there, but they give you a plate of generous and loving, and people touch my skin, like, why? They want to feel what it feels like to be a white man. They would tell me, don't you worry, nothing will happen to you, every one of them. I'm like, wow, these people are amazing, man. And so then I came back and I wanted a message in my music. So the African acid rock, and I want a message. And so when Shag, it was, to me, it was just a, almost a, I don't know what, it was the end of my life. You know,
but then you, I knew it. But then you hooked up with Dino Archon.
Dino was the singer in that band, yeah.
And also that drummer, that extraordinary drummer, Steve Howes. Funny thing is, Jimmy Page talks about the first time he jammed with John Bonham and John Paul Jones and Plante. And he said that he felt like an immediate kinship and an electrifying energy between them. What did you feel the first time that the three of you got down to making music?
There came an unfortunate situation. Robbie Whitelaw got in trouble with the police and the potential got to prison and stuff. And so we were standing outside the Chelsea Hotel. And Shag, I think, had a gig that, but we didn't, now we couldn't play as Shag because he was that shit. And we're standing out there, and so I thought, okay, that's it. I'm leaving this band. And Dino said to me, well, I'll come with you. And I said, no, I don't want you there. And he said, I'll play bass. I said, okay. So we said, well, we've got to go inside and play a gig now. What are we going to call ourselves? And Robbie and I were always into the word asylum. And they always called me the kid. You see, there was Tim Parr, Larry, Amos, there was all those cats, Yoshi, Julian, and Trevor Rabin. They were all the amazing guitar players. And I was the kid. You know, I let the kid play whatever, you know. And so then somebody said, Gary Rathbone, he said, why don't you just call yourself the Asylum Kids? So we went in and we played that gig. And Dino played amazing bass there. Eh? So we decided we'll just stick like that. And we found Steve Howes. And Steve Howes was actually the last drummer of the Shag thing. And we went into the studio at the Des Woodridge, I believe. Mm. They had a little studio there. And that's where we started rehearsing. And Steve, now I didn't like Genesis, right? And Steve loved Genesis. He was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And so anyway, we started. I told him what was this business about, the tribal stuff. And we started doing this thing, and Steve was very annoying because the next rehearsal we'd come, he changed the arrangement, and I told him, dude, it's different, and he's like, no, it's not different. That's the other song, and I realized he was getting the songs mixed up, but he'd argue with me, and so he became the brat. And Gino, coming with these bass lines that, I don't know if it's his Greek upbringing or whatever, but he left holes in places. I was just like, oh, I just put a guitar there. In that hole. So it's almost like he wrote the guitar parts, you know what I mean? Mm. And then Steve was just glued all together. And I was just like, wow. And I think I was in a state of shock still. I still had the kind of negative judgments towards Dino and this brat. And I didn't feel like we were quite getting there.
Well, the Asylum Kids were born, I guess, into a post-punk world in a country where dissension against the status quo was not only frowned upon but persecuted. That first single, Schoolboy, was hardly a radio pop single with its rant against state education and jock culture.
needed to break. The prefect didn't understand. That was all that she could take. The teacher called our principal to exaggerate. I said it happened to a schoolboy. Thinking that he's teaching us torture. Just how much a schoolboy can take. I thought he never was a schoolboy. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, no, sir.
Yes, sir, no, sir.
Sorry again, sir.
Sorry again, sir.
Yes, sir, please, sir.
Song come about? Was it somehow sort of biographical?
Yes, it's 100%. Every story in there is true, you know? How does it start? Levin was... I hated the tie. I always had my tie just a little bit loose. I kind of get a little claustrophobic when shit is around my neck. I don't like those jerseys. And so my tie a little bit loose, you know? And I get in trouble at my school. You weren't allowed to sit something. I can't remember now. I mean, inches you had to be away from a girl. And of course, I wanted to grow my hair long at that time because... I think I might have been one of the first kids at school to grow their hair long because of this exposure to the hippies as a, you know, before I was even in my teens. So all those stories are true, you know. Levin was a clever guy. He never liked to learn, but he couldn't wear a necktie. He said it gave him heartburn. Rules and regulations just pissed me off, you know. And then that thing, I was holding Josephine's hand the first few minutes of break. Teacher didn't understand that was all that she could take. And so... The picture has a principal. The principal says this to me. I say, yes, sir. Yes, no, no, sir. Holding my breath, cursing. It's all the truth, you know. It's actually my experience there at school.
Well, it's so anthemic. I mean, it kind of, when I play it to young people, it still resonates with schoolboys over 40 years later. I mean, so our lives, you and I, intersect in the early 80s when,
yeah,
when
you and
Bob Anderson... Bob Anderson came to see me at We Are Records and played me some of the demos that landed up on Fight It With Your Mind. Yeah. Bob was an interesting character, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a maniac. You see, the thing is with Bob, he was into Guru Maharaji, right?
Right.
So he was vegetarian and he very into the that philosophy and the knowledge and all that and gentle flower of a man until he got into that rotary engine Mazda. And I would beg him and beg him and beg him, please, Bob, slow down. Bob, please. Watch, Bob. Bob, please. It was a nightmare when he was in that car. A completely different cat. Yeah.
But he was a good manager for you.
And he was very good. And he taught me how to run the books for a band because it was all just on paper, you know. We didn't have no QuickBooks and shit. And so I saw how he did things. And we owe him some money, that guy. You know, he, at the end of it, I know that... He was at least $6,000 into it, which is a lot of money, you know, at the time. He just put his heart into it and got us the gigs and never interfered, never told us what to do or not what to do, you know.
Well, that's what a manager should do, shouldn't they?
Yeah, and also Dino. Yeah. Dino is very responsible for that. Sorry, I got to mention Dino because Dino, without Dino, I don't think the Asylum Kids would have gotten further than 2 weeks, you know. Dino and his dad, they facilitated us, they supported us. They, you know, Dino rented the farm and we went out and lived on a farm and got 2-3 albums worth of material from that, you know. He was very, very responsible for that, Dino.
I remember that you and I had many, many conversations over the years about the power of rock music and to change the world and attitudes, but perhaps with hindsight we were a little bit idealistic, but... The title track on the album, Fight It With Your Mind, sounded like a clarion call to action, was it?
About that, it was like that to the audience.
Mm.
But if you look at the lyrics, it's actually Buddhist. You know, the whole idea of emptiness and formlessness and phenomena being united with emptiness. And, you know, of course, 100 years later, now the physicists look into matter and they see it's not there. It's made of non-stuff, you know. Mm. So it was, Dino did philosophy at university, until he read Nausea by Sartre, and then he got nausea and left. So those lyrics are actually Buddhist lyrics. I don't think he meant them to be Buddhist. But the thing is, when we played it, you know, in tandem with songs like Use of Delight and What Kind of Men Are Those, and all those raging policemen. I don't know if we ever recorded policemen, but yeah.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
Then, of course, people thought, fight it with your mind. They were like, you know, we've got to fight. And so it became that anthem, you know. And we played one of the first multiracial gigs in Durban. And what happened is we come on stage and all the people are sitting. And you remember me, I couldn't stand that apathy. You know, if you're sitting, I fucking pick up a radio and play Springbok Radio until you get up, you know. I do all kinds of shit. You remember, I'd berate the audience. And you're fucking lazy. You didn't even make your own beds. You fucking shitting the people out, shitting them out. They're still sitting. And I'm cucking them out, and the next minute they all get up and they start dancing at the song Fight It With Your Mind. And during that song, as we're doing that, people are dancing, the cops come in, cars, and dogs, and the next minute they're beating the people up. But we're right at that moment, fight it. And Dina's looking at me like, I'm looking at him like, what the hell's going on? And the next minute I see, you know, the one guy, one of those Buddha, he's like, hey, coming for me. Next minute, I'm gripped, and I'm chucked under the fucking drum riser. Get in there. Roddy Quinn is hiding me under the drum riser. And all this cracks going on, and people are getting beaten up. He saves Steve from a huge beating up because Steve ran into the bathroom. Dino got attacked by dogs, and it was a big crack scene. But we were right there. Fight it. And while this blooming riot was going on,
Was this in Durban?
In Durban.
Because I remember a similar incident later in Joburg, which I'll come to in a second. But I'm sure you remember the furore over the video of Fight It With Your Mind, which I think
The skull.
Yeah. We made it for 5,000 Rand, I think it was. And it got immediately banned. By the SABC.
Yeah, I heard it was because of the skull, right? That was what was the excuse. The thing was, remember at that time the Stones were banned, and the Beatles, Bob Marley, all that shit was banned. But there was another thing going on. Pink Floyd's We Don't Need No Education was being sung by the kids in the riots.
Yeah, in 76,
and
yeah.
And I think they mixed it up because we got some good press, which I read. When I read, I was like, wait a minute, they're not talking about our song, they're talking about that song. Mm. And so I think that they also made that mistake, thinking that this is the song that the black folk were singing.
Well, I think the Fight It With Your Mind, I think that they would have been attracted to that straight away because it is a bit anarchic, you know, in that sense. But there were other songs on the album that spoke out against the establishment. Bloody Hands is one of them. We Are the One, that springs to mind. I mean, the three of you were really great players. How difficult was it to be expansive musically, to take it out of the three-piece?
No. Let me tell you something. And I can't say I hate myself, but I'm sorry, Dino, and I'm sorry, Steve. Fuck, that music is fucking incredible. I got a live footage of us at Selborne Hall.
I remember
Selborne. And I cannot believe those arrangements. I cannot believe those arrangements. How the hell did we do that? I have no idea. The complexity of it. We didn't, I don't know. I mean, I look at Genesis, how the hell do you write that? We just wrote it. I don't even think we discussed any of this stuff.
Just came
honestly,
out.
Honestly, it just came. But the complexity of the arrangements, and you see me at that Selborne Hall gig, I was drunk as a rat, eh? We had been drinking Southern Comfort all afternoon, and I had to go and play. And I can't believe I never missed a beat, never missed a note. And those arrangements are complex. How do we even remember that shit? The time changes, the key. And it might have been Steve, you know. It might have been Steve, something to do with Steve, because he was a Genesis cat. And I have no idea how we transcended. And we couldn't be a punk band because I was already a pretty good jazz guitarist. Not as good as Josh Clare or anything, but, you know, I was there, you know. And it's like, how do I use jazz in the rock?
And, well, I think sometimes when those kind of experiences happen to you where you look at it later and you can't comprehend how tight and everything works, I mean, it's just something coming out of the spirit, isn't it?
Yeah, it must be, man, because I have no idea. I cannot remember one conversation. I can remember the writing of Girl Gone Solo, because I had that ripped on, and the next minute, Dina, boom, and then we're in there. She's so super, that's how it just came, you know?
It's one of my favorite songs on the album is Girl Gone Solo. Radio, as it was then, wasn't conditioned to play the Asylum Kids. It was something as revolutionary as Fight It With Your Mind. So media exposure was thin on the ground. So it fell to the band live. And you've just talked about the Selborne Hall performance. There's a couple of other performances that stick out to me. The first one is the Jaber Park concert.
That's Selborne Hall, isn't it? That's Selborne Hall.
No, that wasn't Selborne Hall. Selborne Hall was down next to the main city hall, and next to it was Selborne Hall.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. So then I got that name wrong. But that's the one I'm talking about. That one.
Oh, you're talking about that one? Yeah, that's the one where you jumped up and while all the cops were outside, shout, fuck John Foster, fuck the government. And then the tear gas came in and we had to get out of the back through the bathroom window. we all climbed out the bathroom window because there was a riot going on. It was a complete riot.
Yeah, fuck, I don't really remember that one.
And I remember the Vitz Great Hall Vigs, and I've got some stunning photos of that performance. And the audience going ballistic. There's one great shot there. There's a girl in front and you're playing and you're like out there and she's just like, wah! You know, kind of, you know, that beautiful live shot. And then you went on tour with Peach. Remember that?
What a band. They were a great little band.
What was it like being in a band like the Asylum Kids in the middle of Grand Apartheid? What was it like out there?
Well, you know, I've looked back on that quite a bit in my life. I'm thinking about it, and there was a rage in me. There was definitely the anger in me, and in a sense, I found a place for that anger and rage in supporting the revolution, you know?
Mm.
And so it was kind of scary because at the same time, we didn't really know anything, you know? Nobody knew anything really, but I had a friend, Neil Agate. He would come to our house, and I had a room, and in my wall was a false wall. You know, you could pine wood. You know, it's got those grooves, and you can undo it. And he had hidden all kinds of ANC documents in there and stuff like that, and hide them. You know. And so he'd often come to get his documents and do stuff. And in the kitchen, he'd be telling us about, he worked at the Baragwanath Hospital. And so I started learning from him. And then he started giving me literature. And I was like, oh, okay, I got to tell my people. I got to tell people. That's all you do it yourself. You know, the Bodhisattva vow isn't that a big a deal. You hear a great guitar piece, you say, Robbie, listen to this. You know what I mean?
Mm.
And so those books and that knowledge I was getting, not something that many people could get hold of, was like, dude, you got to listen to this. And that was kind of, it's that spontaneous moment of, and that's the Asylum Kids, you know. Like, you got to, you know, the thing about it is that the press was muted. Press wasn't allowed to write about this stuff. And so it was left to the live musicians to unite people in a message and bring the knowledge and conversation of a South Africa without apartheid, you know?
Did you as a band go out of your way to be a megaphone for disillusioned youth? Or was that just a natural development for you?
Yeah, no, that's why I say it's like that thing, you know? It's like if I hear a great Frank Zappa song, I'll be, dude, you got to listen to this, you know?
Right.
So I don't think it was like, oh, no, we're going to be a revolutionary band. I was just pissed off. I was like, you know, it's our laziness, our ignorance, holding these black folk down, and some of my best friends were now black folk. Livingston Pachley, keyboard jazz cat, taught me so much. Alan Quiller, I couldn't walk in the streets with these guys without shitting my pants, driving in the car with them, all this stuff, sleeping in Alexander Township, you know, and hiding. I was sick of it. I was like, no, man. And so it was just the spontaneous, ah.
So the white youth scene, there's a quote, the white youth scene was a powder keg and you were the fuse. Is that true?
I did think that most of the white youth that were around with us, like, for example, Wild Youth, you know, they were singing the same songs about themselves, you know? And most of the lyrics of all the songs are, you know, love songs about themselves. And using the word I a lot, you know, I this, I that. I want to talk about me, you know? This is that thing that was going on, and I was like, no, there's a bigger thing here. Living in that community with Neil Agate and all those people, I was like, there's a bigger issue here than I, you know? Mm. And so, it's possible. But then it was like, you know, like, then people got onto us, and when we played that Vitz Hall gig, they put, what was that band after us? Multiracial band.
National Wake.
National Wake, that's right.
Mm.
And when we went on stage, I mean, you saw the audience rush the stage. It was like everybody was on stage. It was a chaos, right? And then they put on that band and everybody walked away. And it was a bit unfortunate because it was like those guys were not just had the message, the lyrics were very, very valuable, very important. Mm. Radio Rats, all those guys, great lyricists, you know. Mm. And but yeah, in a sense, we were a bloody fuse in a way.
Well, one thing it struck me.
We infused each other.
One thing that it struck me is that throughout the Asylum Kids and Tribe After Tribe, lyrics seem to be the cornerstone of what you've been doing. How important is that to you? Does it just come to you, or is it sort of channel their way into your consciousness, writing about what was happening?
Well, you know, a lot of it with the Asylum Kids came from the news. From a very young age, I was turned. My mom had vinyls of Under Milkwood by Dylan Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
And the Basil Rathbone reading Edgar Allan Poe, stuff like that, Dorian Gray. She had all these vinyls, and I used to listen to them and be like, wow, that's, to me, that Under Milkwood is the first heavy metal album. You know, that, where Richard Burton's reading that thing, you know. And also the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. You can hear me reference that song in the song Ice Below. Below, 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 the ice below. Dylan Thomas is like, the ice, it roared and cracked and bored and below, below the ice. And he's talking about the ship moving through the ice, you know. So I was very into poetry and the power of it. And like I say, those are my first heavy metal records. I thought, you know, that's just like, that's too heavy. And so poetry was very important to me in that sense. And making lyrics that medicine talk is what I used to come up with. I want medicine to speak. I'm not going to just sing about, you know, I lost my baby and this and that. I wanted the medicine talk, you know, something valuable.
That's an interesting point, because you went back into the studio in 82 and recorded Solid Principles, which is a much darker, desolate record. Seems to be handling most of the lead vocals, but the album is bookended by two songs that I think are amongst the most intriguing ever written. And I've been wanting to ask this for many, many years. Tell me about Shore's End, chapters 1 and 2. What was the inspiration for those lyrics?
One is attacking, and you know, the musician's ego and any ego, I suppose, because it's like you know, that whole thing of a man with friends is very prosperous. You know, it's kind of like a Bob Dylan approach to you know, you think you've got all these people around you that you can trust and all that, you know, but in the end, when you're facing the guns, there's a moment of solitude there that you should start getting comfortable with. Because that's the shore's end for you. When those cops come for you, when they come to your house at night time, there's a moment of solitude there that's, if you're not familiar with it, you're filled with terror. And so that's a kind of, in a sense, that's the way, you know. But what was that one? Light bulbs, factories, lights went out, the bomb put Durban in the headline. The kids at school had all worked it out, but they held their breath like I held mine. I don't know. It's about confronting that intense solitude and you know, I love that sentence, the loneliness of a long-distance runner. Met someone recently, they said, Robbie, you were a strange cat. They came to some Asylum Kids gigs and they'd see me in the back room. Everybody's drinking and chining on and I'm just sitting there in solitude and kind of like almost freaked out, you know. And then get on stage and just ignite.
But yeah. after Solid Principles, the band seemed to kind of lose impetus and I think eventually fragmented. What happened with the Asylum Kids?
Well, you know, in fact, at that great City Hall gig where we arrived and there was a line around the block. I'd never seen anything like that before, since Rabbit. And then I walked off stage and I never went back, you know. I was tired of that fighting, you know, fighting to be cool, you know, fighting to be trendy. I sweat in my forehead, sweats, and my eyes burn. That's why I wear a headband when I play live, because it's just, it's painful, you know. Eventually I can't see, you know. And I get into cuck for you know, the way we dress and whatever. And Dino would dress the way he dresses and he'd get into cuck. And so there was a lot of that kind of shit going on. And then, of course, all the punk scene, the sort of new age scene or new wave scene was becoming more apparent. And yes, we weren't keeping up with some of the trends that were going on at the time in Steve's mind, you know.
But those 3 years and those two albums, and I've said this before, and I think you know this because I've told you this. Mm-hmm. I think the Asylum Kids were the greatest rock band to ever come out of this country. And at any other time, in any other geographical location, the Asylum Kids would have been as massive as anybody else out there worldwide. It was a great, great band.
I made a fuck up there. You know that the manager of Queen saw us.
Mm.
And he mentioned this to somebody in the world. And then the Clash fell off the wagon on a Who tour.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob came to me and said, they want to put us on a tour with Who. And I said, fuck the Who. Arrogant. And I can't believe that. And then Bobby said, are you sure? And there's actually a photograph of us standing outside Bob's apartment the very day that he said that. And I can't believe that. I think I was mad in my brain. I wasn't a silent kid. Fuck the Who.
Wow. I never
That's
knew
ridiculous,
that.
You know? Yeah.
Fill me in on the next move, tribe after tribe. How did that come about? Did you feel that you wanted to move away from that trio format and kind of expand the sound with keyboards and there was certainly a change in material there.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was that that haunting thing of the African acid rock, you know, that I didn't quite affect. I came a little bit closer on the Solid Principles album. I wanted to get back into that thing. And Bruce was a good friend of mine, you know, through Backstop. I got him into Backstop. And him and I met at Entertainment Call in Victoria, in Voortrekkerhoogte, the Army. And we'd stand beat there on the weekends and we'd jam and stuff. And so we had this relationship. And he was now playing drums. And I wanted to explore what Simple Minds were doing on the top. That thing where this guitar was almost invisible and it was part of keyboards. And then underneath was this thunderous drumming, you know? And I was like, so how can we do that, Bruce, where we can blend this atmosphere, or the Brian Eno business, Robert Fripp and all that stuff? How can we blend all that with this African drums? And then Fuzzy wasn't doing anything. He's like, bring Fuzzy in. Fuzzy's into Genesis. He's also got this prog rock business. And Bruce went on to keyboards. And then we found Nils. And Nils, take away your cymbals. And so for a couple of weekends, he played without cymbals because I wanted that African thing. And then Peter Gabriel started doing it, and then Talking Heads. And it's like, hey, we had this idea. Let's just dig in there, you know. But still confused. How to make a song with that in it? How to make a song with all that guitar stuff that I had in my mind, you know? I was making a mistake right there. I should not have been thinking about songs. I should have been thinking about atmospheres, because you can't develop the trance in 2 minutes of drumming.
Mm.
It has to go a bit longer. You play. First 3 minutes, you're just playing the past. Next minute, you're trying to go somewhere. Next minute, you transcend all that and you're in a moment and you're playing stuff you've never heard before. It takes maybe 15 minutes to get there, to get to that Miles Davis, to get to that gorgeous place. You know, there's a sweet spot. It takes a little time. And so that was my mistake with the tribe, trying to squash all that lust for that feeling into songs. And it didn't work.
We're talking about atmosphere. I mean, that stunning version of Dylan's As I Went Out One Morning, in the grand scheme of things, and Gavin and I were talking about it earlier, because it's the first thing when I walked into the studio tonight, he was humming As I Went Out One Morning. and it has got to be up there with Jimmy's version of All Along the Watchtower as a career-defining interpretation of a Dylan song. How did that version come about? That aye, aye, oh.
As I went out one morning to breathe the air around Tom Paine, I spied the fairest damsel that ever did walk in chains. I offered her my hand. She took me by the arm, and I knew that very instant she was meant to do me harm. I am.
I am.
Well, that was a total fluke, you know. We were at a sound check, and I started playing that song, and I was like, we're not just at the sound check, and Bruce started playing the keyboard with me, clank, 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 clank. And what was the Scottish band, Big Country?
Yeah.
They had a song out at that time, and it had a chant like that in it. And I was just, you know, playing the Dylan song, and then I just threw the sort of a Big Country chant on it. And then, and we just kept rolling the song. It was all there was a song there. We played it that night. we didn't try to write it. We just like, that's it. Play that. Let's just do that. And it became this enormous hit.
Mm.
And I Dylan.
Are you a Dylan fan?
Oh, you got to be kidding me! I actually forget to tell you that about the lyrics. Yeah, Bob Dylan. In the hippie days, when I was at the monastery with the hippies coming, there was one guy, the Yoshi, very into Dylan, and he'd sing these songs, and I'd be like, what the hell, who wrote that? He said, Dylan. So eventually I got Dylan live, and then eventually I think my first live gig, I opened up with Williams and Zinger killed poor Harry Carroll. He was doing that racism there, right, talking about that, with the cane that he wore on his diamond ring finger. What a beautiful opening to a line, you know. Here comes the story of a hurricane. Pistol shots ring out in a ballroom night. What an opening. And I'm like, fucking, it's all about racism. Dylan, I learned almost all the songs. There isn't a Dylan song that I can't sing, that I don't know, or I haven't played at least once, you know. Mm. I got very, very into Dylan. And people tell me, oh, no, I don't like Dylan. I can't sing and stuff like that. And I said, play it on the piano. Play that melody line on the piano. And you'll see this guy's got more melody in his music than Stevie Wonder and all those cats put together. There isn't enough melody. Bach would have written maybe that melody. Never mind the lyric, you know?
Mm.
Darkness at the break of noon, shadows of silver spoon, handmade bed, bland, you know? It's all right, Ma, I'm only bleeding. My mom used to say to me, Robert, stop it. Stop it with the politics, you're going to get in trouble. It's all right, Ma, I can take it. And I apologize for the night we met. When I grabbed you by the throat and put you up against the wall, and I said, Benji, you fuck with my brother, I'll fucking kill you. I didn't even know you. Who the hell am I? I didn't know anything about music business. Never heard of a record company ripping off a band. I mean, where the hell did that come from? Arrogance.
I don't even remember it.
Oh, good.
As I went out one morning, was a huge hit. It was such a big hit that EMI reissued the Power album with that track on it. So there were two versions of the album that were out at the same time. Yeah, I did not know that. So there's four extra tracks on the second issue of it, including As I Went Out One Morning. I'll actually find a copy and send you a picture of it. Was the album a success? I can't remember. I know the single was massive.
Then MTV played that one of the songs from there, which had quite a lot of African drumming in it. I can't remember what the name of the song is, but and they also, those lyrics were all veiled, you know? So it was successful in the sense that they never got the message. They never saw. But there was The Suburb in the South on that record, which closed down a couple of festivals when we played it with Inkosa Sikelele as a guitar solo.
That's bound to get some attraction, yeah. What happened then? Because did you get gutful of what was going on here and fold the band in and made that decision to go to America? What prompted that decision to leave?
No, I mean, the thing is, Dino and I think he was gutful, you know. It's like we're banging our heads here. And so he left to go to America. And I was like, okay, he's off to go make a gig in America. Di Bruken was there. Remember, she was what was the big African band, funk rock band, very famous band? Harari. She was the manager, I think, for Harari, you know. And she was in America. And she said, you got to bring this on, kids. You got to bring this on. Again, I was the arrogant guy. Fuck the who, fuck America, you know. And no good. Anyway, so then we got into more and more cuck. And one thing led to another. Then Neil got killed. And they came to our house looking for shit there. We'd come home and there'd be guys hiding behind the trees and stuff. And then I did a very stupid thing. I gathered 15 of our fans and we went and we attacked the AWB at the city hall. And that was a nightmare. That was a stupid thing to do. And through that situation, the AWB got to know who I was and where I lived and all that stuff. And they were in the cop, then there were a lot of them were cops. And so the cuck started. We'd arrive at gigs and all our wires would be cut. We'd arrive at gigs and suddenly somebody would get stabbed and there was this mayhem. I'd walk into the gig hall and the guy would be standing at the door. He's like, I see you, Betwicher. I see you, you know. I was like, who's that? Who's that? You know, it's just like, well, they were coming closer, coming closer. So I was realized we were in trouble. Roddy Quinn was having a hard time getting us any work and stuff. And he was amazing, actually, in that he really tried to shelter us from all of that stuff that was coming our way. And so it just got scarier and scarier. And we were writing to artists and Aesthetics Against Apartheid saying, listen, yeah, we're getting stopped here. We can't play in gigs. Well, Johnny Clegg apparently said to the promoters, now I don't know if it's all true, but he said he wouldn't play that big festival unless Tribe could play, Robbie could play, you know. So he was standing with us, Roddy was standing with us, but the shit was coming down, we were getting cut off, we weren't allowed to do certain gigs, we weren't on the radio, all the stuff was getting on and on. Then eventually, and then the AWB were coming closer and closer and closer, and very scary. And so then they decided, just get the hell out. Go, and they threw us out to Hollywood. I would never have gone to Hollywood in my life. Yeah, I would never have done such a thing because I was into, you know, all the English bands, you know. We were landing in Hollywood, and Roddy had hooked us up with the Screen Gems there, and they gave us $50,000 right there. And I'm like, what? And so then it was like, okay, bring all the guys, let's go. We're in America now, you know. It wasn't really a decision of, okay, we fucked here, let's go to America, you know? It was kind of a little bit of an escape from the cut that I'd caused. You see, I wasn't as diplomatic as Johnny Clegg. Johnny could do a good speech and handle that, all that stuff with medicine. I was up against it, like, fuck you, you know, we're fighting, we're fighting. And I attracted the fighting. So it was just too much, and I went there, and then the money came. And then I was like, oh, Clay, we're going to make African acid rock here. And then all the record companies were wooing us, taking us to concerts, giving us dinners, oh, money. Put the drum beat on the 2 and 4, and you can be the next U2. Killed me. I can't listen to U2 again in my life. They just killed me there. And I couldn't write songs. I'm like, I don't even know how to do this shit anymore. And it's like, how do I get back to it? Went and bought my first Johnny Winter record. To remind myself, okay, this is why I got into music, Johnny Winter, okay? Now, there was another album, very, 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 my top 10, what's it called? If only I could remember my name.
David Crosby. Yeah, I was couldn't listening find to that.
It. Yeah, I couldn't find it anyway. So eventually we said, no, fuck this, we're not going to do no record labels, no more record labels. We make our own little cassette. And we hit the road with a cassette. We do it the way that Metallica did it. They had their own record, they put it in a trunk, and they went and they played and they sold it, and they became this big hit. Well, this is how we're going to do it. No record label. So we make this thing, and the cassette lands up record label. Record label calls me and says, hey, I want to sign you guys. I said to him, no, I'm sorry, arrogance. I'm sorry, we don't do record labels. He says, no. I don't want no demos. I said, I don't do demos. I don't do showcases. That's it. He says, no, I don't want you to do a demo. I don't want you to do a showcase. I want you to release that music I've heard just as is. Just master it. I said, nah, man. He says, look, why don't you just come out here and we'll talk about it.
Was I'll that Megaforce?
Yeah. Johnny Cezula.
Yeah.
I go out there. I walk into his office. He's got his back to me as I walk in. He's there standing at his record player. And he turns around and he says, hi, have you heard this record? And it's, if only I could remember my name.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, okay, where do I sign? And then, of course, we got into the big conversation about Captain Beefheart. Who, if somebody played Captain Beefheart at a party, I would go tell the DJ, please take that off. doesn't belong to these people. Arrogant. Anyway, so that's how that started off, you know. And so he was, he signed us, and just as is. Then Pearl Jam heard the tape, and they, so I was tripping on acid on a tour in Ohio, and a friend of mine hadn't heard the new Nine Inch Nails. And I said to him, what? We're going to go right now and buy it. So we went to the music store, little girl behind the counter, gorgeous, said, I'll buy anything you sell me. She says, yeah, take this. It's Pearl Jam. Tripping on acid, listen to that. I was like, wow. Get back to LA. Dude, this is amazing. Listen. Turning all my friends onto it. Phone call. Hi, Pearl Jam want to take you on tour. I said, now who's this? You know, one of my friends maybe? Turned out to be true. They want to take us on tour. Took us all over the world. Fantastic. Played all the biggest arenas. Hammersmith, Odeon, all that shit that you dream about as kids.
You had that self-titled album. I mean, the band sounded far more primal. Especially on White Boys in the Jungle. There wasn't a band that sounded like Tribe After Tribe in America at that time. Everything was either frat boy dude rock or cock rock. How did the media and audiences react to you?
Yeah, no, that was interesting because, you see, when I arrived in America, it looked to me like there were only four musicians in LA and they played in all the bands. All the bands looked the same, sounded the same, all that stuff, you know what I mean? And I couldn't relate to that. To me, Eddie Van Halen was king and that was done with that. You know what I mean? I'm running for this nonsense, you know? So, and the record label's trying to put us into that, that little hall. But on one of the showcases, this is a magical story. On one of the showcases we're doing for RCA Records, they rented this huge place, SIR Studios, and there we were going to show their, our wares, you know, our goods to the record label. And we were already cut full of that. And then I'm standing there looking at the stage to see that it's all good. And I'm looking at everything and this funny little man comes up to me. Looks like a little goblin, you know. And he looks at me and he says to me, who are you? I look at this other man, what the fuck? Who am I? I'm Robbie Robb. I've been in the room with Elvis Presley, Willie Nelson. I know you're somebody. Who are you? I said, I'm Robbie Robb, dude. Elvis, huh? He says, here's my card. Anyway, and he takes my number. We played the gig. A couple months later, he calls me. Hey, what's so great about Pink Floyd? I'm like, well, you know, they got the melody, they got this. No. They did it their own way. And he hang up laughing. Ha, 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 I need hang up. What the fuck is this guy? Find out who he is. Who is this fucking guy? You know who he was? Bob Johnson, producer of Blonde on Blonde, Bob Dylan. So anyway, a little more respect for the guy now, right? Calls me again. What's so fantastic about The Who? I said, well, you know, arena rock, space opera, whatever, you know. He said, no, they did it their own way. And we hang up. Eh? And so now we cut forward, and I started saying, wait a minute, I need to use Bob Johnson as producer. And I told some of the record labels, they said, no, he's a has-been, don't use him. No. Bad idea. So when we decided, no, we're going to make our own record, no record label, anything like that, and I'm calling Bob Johnson to come and produce. Bob Johnson comes in there. We take him to the studio. We've got 10 days. We've got money enough for 10 days. We walk in there to the studio. He says to the studio manager, we're starting to record on this date. I don't want no secretaries here. I don't want you here. I don't want nobody here. No bookkeepers, nobody. No A&R people come in the studio. Nobody. You just all go home. And I'm like, oh, Bob, careful. And he's like, no, this is what's going to happen. So we go in the studio, no secretaries, nobody. He comes in there with big jugs of coconut water and juices and all kinds of great flowers everywhere. And we start the recording session with getting the headphone mix. Okay? No big deal. We're all in a room together, got the headphone going. Okay? When are we going to start? He's like, 4 days later, still with the headphone mix. I'm losing my mind. I'm like, fucked up. I shouldn't have used this guy. What was I thinking? After 4 days, or on the fourth day, we got a headphone mix that sounds like blooming listening to Pink Floyd. You play a note, like, whoa. Everybody's like, whoa. And we recorded it that afternoon. We recorded the whole album. One day. And then we start mixing and doing final vocals. And we're getting tired. And my engineer brings in the white powder, the cocaine. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to take it. Because I'm tired. I'm going to take it. And I'm about to take it, and Bob says to me, Robbie, just come here. And he takes me out, and he says, listen here, you've come so far, don't do it. And I went in there, and I sang that whole album, and then they wanted me to do the first song, I Remember, again. Mm-hmm. And I took the cocaine. Mm. And I went in that studio, and I sang it. And I thought I did a great job, and I come outside, and Bob says to me, you did it, didn't you? You did the cocaine. I said, no. Yeah, I know I did. And he said, listen to it. And you can hear the difference, eh? And so we went with the first take where I didn't do the cocaine. And then, of course, we had the fight with they didn't want to open with that song. And I said, no, we've got to open with that song. That's everything. That's me. It's Remember. Mm. Remember Africa. Remember the poverty. Remember why it's poor, you know? And all that stuff, and it's got that African opening, you know those thunderstorms in South Africa in the afternoon. So it starts off with that darkness in the jungle. You let the well run dry. You know, it's like a prayer to Mother Africa. And yeah, we did all that stuff, and I got it my way. Jim Scott was producing at this point because we were redoing the album, and he said to me, "We're gonna need to cut that intro. It's way too long." So yeah, you're right. Let's cut it. Cut the intro. Struggling with the song, we struggle. Like, this is a shit song. Why write a stupid song? How the fuck do I write a stupid song? Okay. And then one day Jim said to me, let's just put the introduction back in there. We put it back in and it's like, there the song was. So I had no idea. That was just, you gotta give time for the spirit to come in. You don't just force the spirit like you do a credit card, put it in and comes out. You gotta give time, let that thing build. Let the spirit come, and when it comes, you start singing.
Yeah.
So over the next few years, you released under Tribe After Tribe, another sort of roughly five albums. But during that time, you morphed from band leader to collaborator with Jeff Ament to Pearl Jam and recorded two very different kinds of records under the name Three Fish. Yeah. I mean, the guitars were still there, but there was, but you had added like to this heady mix, like exotic instruments like Turkey Saz and Arabic Oud and old keyboards. And I'm intrigued. You've got the word paintbrushes. You use paintbrushes
in
the recording.
Yeah.
Anything you could find. How did that happen? And what's with the name Three Fish?
Okay, so we toured all over the world and twice through America with opening up for Pearl Jam. And at that time, I was a student of the Aleister Crowley College. I was actually a hierophant in that in his college, you know, and very into that mysticism and hermetic and Kabbalah and all that. And we arrive in Kansas, get off the bus. Jeff gets off his bus. I don't know what to say to these guys. They're getting famous here. I can't stand famous people. I'm like, hey, what book are you reading? Oh, that was my opening line. He says, oh, I'm reading this thing. I said, oh, very, very good. Thank you. That was the Aleister Crowley book he was reading. And so, boom, we got this connection, you know, mysticism and all that. And we would have long conversations about all kinds of stuff. And he's very fascinated by it. Anyway, they start cracking it on the road, right? They start getting famous, 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 famous. And now they're the biggest band in the world. And I saw what was happening to them emotionally as human beings. And I said, nah, I don't want that. That's horrible. Mm. That's just fucking horrible. I want to be Pink Floyd, where he can walk through the audience and nobody knows who they are, you know? And so one day, the guitar player says to me, Robbie, you need to take Jeff for a walk. I say, okay, I understand. So I say, Jeff, hey, why don't we meet up in Big Sur? Big Sur's got the hot tubs on the edge of the cliff. Unbelievable place. You sit there at midnight, the stars, the ocean crashing way down there. Joseph Campbell, all these great mystics have sat there and had conversation. We're sitting there having a conversation, and it's a beautiful time we're having, and I could see what's going on with him, and I'm giving him medicine. And then he says, he's got to go. I said, where are you going, man? We can't leave now. We're like, I said, if I touch a guitar right now, blow up the universe, how can you leave now? He says, I've got to go to Neil Young, man. I said, fuck Neil Young, bro. This is the shit right here. He's like, no, I gotta go. No, man. He says, come with me. I said, fuck, okay, let's go. I wasn't interested in this. We get there to Neil Young's farm. Suddenly I wake up and say, Neil Young, wait a minute. Hey, what am I doing here? I said, you go ahead. So he goes off and I get dressed. I put my kakoi on. I got my long dreadlocks. I said, fuck, I better go up there and say hi. And I walk up there. And I'm walking in. And the next thing, they all sitting at the table there, Pearl Jam and Neil Young, and I'm like, ah, and they're all pointing at me and laughing at me. I'm like, what the fuck? This is what I need now, you know? I get there, turns out the sun was setting behind me, and I was like this apparition coming because of my quite African dreadlocks, you know? And he says to me, Neil Young does this to me. Hi, takes his glass, dark glass off. I'm Neil Young. I shake hands and I'm like, wow, this was amazing, you know? That's manners, you know? Later on, I'm sitting on the hill by myself, ignoring them. Here comes Neil Young walking up the hill, sits down next to me, takes his glasses off, he says, do you like cars? I'm like, look, I don't even know what you say. I don't even know what to call you. Are you Mr. Young? I've got so much respect. Are you Mr. Young? Or I can't call you Neil. It just doesn't fit in South African style. You're the fucking Oni, you know? Big vibe there. He takes me to see his cars. All this beautiful stuff happens. And we leave there. And Jeff says, let's go into the studio and jam. Because he remembers, I said to him, if I touch a guitar now, I'm going to blow the universe up. Now, I've just been hanging out with Neil Young, who thinks I'm very fascinating. He loves talking to me. And we jammed for one whole hour in front of the fireplace. Me and Neil Young, I'm playing Baba Mal on my fucking guitar. And he's hoying that guitar, turned that guitar into Sonic Youth. Who's the guitar? Couldn't believe I had dropped the groove on what now. You know. So now it was like beyond, if I touch a guitar, I'm going to blow up. We go into the studio. And we set up, and it's not even a studio, it's like a living room, but it's a studio, it's got a proper room and all that. And we just start, and we just sing and play. Never wrote a lyric. There was a young kid there, friend of Jeff's, who was doing literature at university. And he was talking to me all the time. And wonderful conversations. I'd wake up with these lyrics in my head and go in and just sing. Never wrote anything down. Afterwards, wrote it all down. We were into Rumi. The Sufi poet. And I was writing a screenplay on Rumi's life. And so Rumi wrote the poem about the three fish. So Jeff said, let's call ourselves Three Fish. He designed a nice piece of art. And we're like, yeah, that's great. Let's call it Three Fish. And so that's why that first album, I think all those bands, the grunge bands, were fantastic. They weren't one shit one, you know. Every one of them were brilliant. But that album, I think, just sliced them down. Now, Sony saw what happened to that album. And they wanted to release it. And I said, Jeff, no, let's not. Please, let's not go with the label. He said, no, he asked you why he owes them anyway. So, oh, fuck, okay, go with them. Many, 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 many years later, I'm in Germany on tour, and there comes the A&R cat. It's like, you know, I worked for Sony when you released that Three Fish. I said, oh, yeah, how was that, you know? Yeah, they came into the office, and they said, Robbie and Jeff are coming into town. Make it look good. And I said, what does that mean? You know? So, no. They were not into promoting you. You guys were a threat to Pearl Jam. And so they bullshitted us. They didn't promote us. They basically shelved the album, yeah. But without letting Jeff know, because they didn't want to piss him off, you know. So make it look good. Anyway, that album is very, very potent album. And now, interesting thing is, you see, I didn't like my voice. I loved when Dino was singing. I didn't like my voice. I was a stupid kid. I heard Robert Plant and I heard Janis Joplin, and I was like, that's it. I'm singing like that. This wasn't me. I should be singing like Donovan, not like that. And get in the studio, and now I've got to sing in front of this engineer who's Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, all these great singers, you know. I'm not going to fool this guy. And so I just remember what Bowie said, sing, speak. So I just started there. Dawn breaks, I am alone, I'm awake, but my eyes won't open. I said, fuck it, Rob, there you are. I found my voice. First time in my life, you know, I think.
So for the last decade or so, you've been driving the Third Ear Experience. It's a musical platform that some have described as stoner rock or jam band or space rock meets world music. I'm sure you find those labels inhibiting. So tell me, what is the Third Ear Experience?
So I got a house in the desert, in Joshua Tree. When I landed up in America under those circumstances, big surprise, overnight rush, I was freaked out. I couldn't stand that. Hollywood was driving me nuts. I was scared. We had been attacked in the forest in South Africa just before we left. And I was terrified. Everyone was going to burn me. Everyone is going to burn me. You know what I mean? I'm like walking under strangers. But the buildings are short. It's dirty. I can't take it. The TV, the sound of the American accent was driving me nuts. I was like, fuck, I can't stand this. I'm going to die. And so they said to me, you should go to the desert to decompress. I said, okay, I go to the desert. Driving. I was like, what? You're in the desert. No, this is not the desert. There's bushes, there's trees. No, this is the desert. It looked like Karoo. I said, well, this is not a desert to me. But anyway, little country and western motel there, and owned by a producer. The producer says to me, you should go to Pappy and Harriet's. What is that? Country and western bar. I said, no, I'm not going there. I don't need no violence, you know what I mean? I got the dreadlocks. Eventually I go there, the big man comes to me, I hear you're a musician. I'm like, yeah, don't move me, please. And he says, go and play with the band. Like, what, a country band? I know one country song. He says, go play it. I'm like, okay, don't move me. I get up there and I play, and the people loved it. The country and west people, they fucking stand applaud. And I get off the stage, and this woman standing there, big boobs, arms wide open, and she gives me a hug, and I cry like a baby. I was so traumatized from that whole leaving South Africa, I couldn't believe it. And when I hit her, it's boom, I just wept. And I was like, okay, this is my place. I'm staying here. So I live in a desert, meet this guy. He's an astronomer, and he has the big telescopes, and he built this big screen, and he goes and he puts his telescopes into space, and he finds the galaxies out there, double galaxies, stuff you cannot believe. And he projects it onto the screen, and he says, now I want you to play music here. I said, okay, very good. Get there. And now I'm starting, my baby said she gonna leave me, my baby. And I'm looking at this galaxy. I'm like, what are you fucking singing about? Stop it. And I was, wait a minute. Okay, let's just play. Do that. Let's play that. And we start playing that. And the music just was unbelievable. What are we, my guitar playing, all that jazz, all that stuff I've been studying all those years. Here's the place. This is the place. And I'm like playing like you can't believe. I'm putting jazz chords with the delays and the echoes. And I'm like, oh my God, this is the place. So that was the birth of 30A Experience. Now, when I was with Mike Dickman, he turned me on to the 30A Band. Remember that funny record? Then there was the other big influence, Otis Waygood, the 30A Records or whatever Mark called himself. Eh?
David Marks' records, yeah.
30A. So I was like, okay, this is it. I'm home. Jimi Hendrix Experience. 30A Experience. This is it. Now, call yourself that and become that.
Is that a set band? Is that a set band or is it a revolving group of musicians?
At that time, I thought I didn't want to have a set band. I'm just going to call in the best cats that I know.
Mm.
And that, but living in the desert, there's very few people. So the bass player was very often. And the Three Fish drummer was often. He lived in San Francisco, though. It was hard to find a drummer down here. Still is. But, yeah, so then it became this music that we would play. I started working with this place. It's an art gallery, theater, whatever. I built it up. It's a big Quonset hut. And we would just sit inside there and put all the recording gear and just jam for 2 or 3 days. And I'd sit and take the best parts and release it. 1 weekend, we make 3 albums. You know what I mean? No hassle. And the press, best album of the year, best album of the best album, blah, blah, blah. Forefront of the genre, all this praise. Got more praise from those albums and all that shit when I was in Hollywood trying to make a hit and what, and trying to write a song and how do I combine the African with this and that. And so much thinking. And I turned out, wait a minute, it's all about listening. You play with each other and you listen. And you listen and you listen until Jimi Hendrix said, he wakes up and he plays a riff. A couple of hours, you'll play the same riff. I remember Larry do that. You wait until the next riff tells you what it is. Okay, so guys, this is the story. We're going to play this song. The only thing I want you to have in your mind is wedding dress, you better be buying me a wedding dress. That's the only thing I want you to have. I don't want you to play it. If I hear you play that, you're disqualified. And so everybody have the same song in their head, and we start jamming. And just go, and let that song, the spirit of that song, dislocate from its melody, enter us, and now we're listening to each other. And listen, oh, here comes an idea from the drummer, follow that. Here comes an idea, follow that. And so it was all about this morphing. And then we had to take it on tour. And I was like, oh, God. And now, because we're in the desert, they link us up with this desert stoner nonsense, which has got nothing to do with marrow. They're all beer drinkers, those guys. Big drunkards and, you know, womanizers. They're not fucking stoner rock at all. I don't know what kind of dacha they're smoking, put it that way. Anyway, so now we're on tour, doing all these big desert festivals, huge fucking, and all these heavy, they're almost heavy metal, you know. How the hell are we going to go down with this shit there? We start, Steve says, jam, I brought Steve on that tour. Jam, just jam. Okay, here we go. Let's just start off with this beautiful jam. We jam, we get to this beautiful place, it all works out great. We go, suddenly we're crashing, we're falling, and Steve and I looking at each other, what's going to happen? We find each other, and the audience applauds. And we look at the audience, what? And I fucking open up my solos, and I finish my solo, and the audience applauds. What? They were so with us, they were following every fucking detail. They could see this music was being created right there. They loved it, they loved the vulnerability of it. They loved it. It was like, okay, we've got it. We've got freedom.
So it's all unrehearsed. It's just
unrehearsed.
You let the spirit move you, take you wherever it goes.
Yeah, yeah. Never controlling. Nobody's talking to anybody about anything. None of that unless something like, we actually tried that once. We got together. We started writing songs. We wrote a whole bunch of songs. But we'd wake up first, have a jam, record the jam, and then write the songs. And at the end, I listen to the songs, I listen to the jams, and I'm like, are you kidding me? We got to release the jams again. Forget about the songs. Next time, maybe. Never got to release that song stuff. Just the jams.
Ever since I've known you, there's always been a very strong spiritual slant to what you've done musically. And so here you are, I mean, over 40 years since you began this journey with the Asylum Kids through countless incarnations to 30-year experience.
Yeah.
Are you still on a quest?
Yeah. There's a beautiful book called The Sound of Mysticism of Music. You know? Mysticism of Sound and Music, or something like that, by Inrad Khan. And in this book, he talks about this instrument, the veena. Now, I want to show it to you. It's an unbelievable instrument, okay? Well, I might show you afterwards, but anyway, so this instrument is supposed to replicate the voice. And so that's it. I'm leaving rock and roll. I'm playing this thing. And I start learning to play this thing. It takes some lessons. Unbelievable instrument. I can't believe this instrument. Anyway, so, and the way to learn this instrument is you take the name of the goddess and you play it 1,000 different ways. How do you take one word and play it 1,000 different ways? You know how you do that? Well, ask Jeff Beck. You know, you take that one little note and you fucking work that shit. I was like, okay, this is it. I'm out of rock. This is it. I'm going down this path. Anyway, somebody said, walks past my house. They said, hey, every time I walk past you, I have this beautiful music. Do you want to make a soundtrack for a documentary? No, thank you. I'm just playing the name of the goddess. Arrogant. I'm not. Mm. He says, oh, it's a story about the goddess. I'm like, what? Okay, let me see the producer. In walks this gorgeous woman and my future wife. And I speak to her husband. He's like a Johnny Zula kind of guy. Like, no, I'm not doing that, but I'll make a record with you. We make a spiritual record. She's very into the chanting of the divine names. Ha, here's my instrument. I'm ready for this. Let's go. And so for 22 years, we're chanting the divine names. I'm learning this instrument. It's coming on my guitar. I'm learning to be devotional. How do I sacrifice? How can I get my ego out of it? How do I get this? How do I get that bird out of my heart to go? Fucking take wing.
Robbie Rob.
And so now I fucking start writing a love album.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to make a love album now. And 15 years I've been working on this album, and it's a ballet. So not only do I have to write these words, but I have to watch, I have to in my mind watch a ballet happening and play to that. And some of those pieces of music, oh, that's too long, I've got to cut it. No, no, wait, what's the dancer doing? Oh, okay. So I've almost finished that album now. The next 2 weeks, this album's going to be finished. Twilight Sutra. And I cannot believe the lyrics. You've got to hear the lyrics. I didn't write those lyrics. That lyric is unbelievable.
I'll look
the
for
guitar
them, yeah.
Playing, Benji. The guitar playing. Forget about it. You listen to that, you say, that's not Robbie Robb. That's not Robbie Robb. That's something else. So Quest, I don't know. But something came that came maybe from years of questing, requesting. I don't know.
A fascinating conversation with you, my friend. I look forward to hearing this album. Thanks so much for being on From the Hip.
Thank you very much.
It's been cool catching up.
From the Hip, exclusively on Solid Gold Podcast.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.